Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trade and graphic novels. Today we are reviewing Ball Peen Hammer by Adam Rapp and artwork by George O'Connor. And this is a sort of a sci-fi futuristic book about a dystopian future where we don't really know what's going on, but there's been some sort of disease or infection. I think they call it the infection or something, right, where people die from it, and it seems pretty bad. And we just kind of see glimpses that everything is just all gone wrong, essentially, in this world.
Yeah.
We don't really get to see what this world is like. This is really more a story between about four characters.
Mm-hmm.
Those characters being Exley, a girl, Horlick, a boy. So a relationship between those two.
And right, Exley's an older girl. Exley's teens, 20s. Early 20s. Yeah.
And then Welton, a musician, and Aaron Underjohn, who's a writer, and their relationship together. Right. And then we find out there's a link between the four different people. Right.
You know, like you said, this book is, we don't really know a whole lot about the world and what's going on. And I think that that's what makes this book so disturbing to mm-hmm. read, is that there is no logical reason for any of this. That it anybody almost knows, but yet everything works in such a logical, precise, articulated manner.
It feels like there's a cloud pressing down on you the whole time, mm-hmm. like just not understanding why things are the way they are, and it really sets a tone for this whole book. Yeah. And so I think it was really well done doing that, although I would like another book that kind of fleshes out what's going on even more. But that being said, this was a standalone book that I can enjoy if nothing else is written.
Right. There's a, like you said, pushing down on you. There's a real sense of oppression and claustrophobia in this book.
Uh-huh.
This entire book really takes place in the confines of one building, that you have two of the characters, Aaron and Welton, living in the basement. And then two other characters, Exley and Horlick, living upstairs in basically the clock room. They're in this building.
And they were in the same building, correct?
Right, they're in the same building. Exley and Horlick are living in this room behind where all the clockworks had been on this giant clock tower. And so everything takes place in these two rooms, and that just adds to the oppressive feeling.
And there's always tight shots on every single person in here. So it almost feels as if there's absolutely no room in either of these spaces either. And the way that I think that he really helps that out is anytime he shows an outside shot of the buildings, you get this sense of space, but it's always dark and it's always raining, which right. really just closes in around the reader.
Yeah, there is no sense of space out here. There's no sense of escape.
Mm-hmm.
Everything pushes you inside. There's packs of wild dogs that roam the street. The rain, there's a whole comment there about the rain actually burns now, and it seems like it's raining all the time. And yeah, it's just, what a horrible, horrible place to be. Yeah,
you get the feeling that you don't want any of these characters to step outside. Anytime they're talking about going outside, I have this feeling like, no, don't go outside, right. just stay where you are.
Right.
And that's a great atmosphere to build this suspense of this book around. Really, I mean, there's very little that happens. It's just the interactions between these characters. But because of this beautifully dense, oppressing atmosphere that both Adam Rapp and George O'Connor have built for us, there's incredible tension in this book.
There is. It's I liken this to reading a Chuck Palahniuk book that is such a just disturbing, delightfully disturbing feel to it all that I mean, I enjoyed reading this book and I felt uncomfortable through the whole thing. I mean, it was not a pleasure. I enjoyed it. And, you know, I left feeling kind of like you are. Dear God, let there be a sequel to this. But at the same time,
do I really want it?
Because, you know, like you said, there's so much of this world that we don't understand. And I'm not sure I want to understand it because the plot of this story, or not even really the plot, the background of this is that there is some sort of organization to all of this where there are baggers and there are
draggers.
There's, hang on, where is it? He says
isn't that sackers and draggers.
I gotta find the number here. Here we go. Draggers get 2 digits, sackers get 3. And sackers clunk kids on the back of the head with a ball peen hammer. And then they sack them up in these burlap sacks, basically. The draggers help the sackers drag them to a specific location where they wait for the man or the collector to come and collect them.
Yeah. So there's this strict organization going on here where these people have a purpose, and it's this horrible purpose that they do, but they just sort of do it in this world where we get a sense that there's just massive chaos going on.
Right. And you get the feeling like they're doing this because it offers them some sense of protection. They are in...
like they get this space to use and live in that's their own private space.
That's so much better than what everyone else has because they have running water.
Mm-hmm.
They have running water and some sort of protection from the dogs and the people outside. But yeah, that in exchange for this, they're basically doing this horrible job that they don't understand why.
Yeah, they have no idea. There's these rules set up and these axioms set up that they follow, but they have no rhyme or reason as to why they follow them or what the purpose is for following them. And so that's... so we find out that Welton, the musician, is a sacker, right?
He's a dragger.
Oh, he's a dragger?
Welton's the dragger because he's got 2 digits.
Okay.
And sackers get 3. So what ends up happening is Aaron Underjohn is told where the place, where Welton is living.
Uh-huh.
And leaves his stuff there while Welton is sleeping. When Welton wakes up, he realizes that someone has been there because he sees Underjohn's stuff. He finally meets Underjohn and goes through the whole explanation for him. And that's where you kind of find out that Underjohn is going to be the new sacker.
Uh-huh.
And so basically they work in a team. That the sacker is supposed to work with the dragger, and then the collector will come. And the collector, we actually see the collector. The collector plays various roles in this book. He actually interacts with almost all of the characters in the book, and he is just a giant of a man.
Yeah.
Who...
with a bald head and goggles.
Yeah, like blackout goggles.
Uh-huh.
And he seems... I don't know. He's designed to be... the character design is one of a guy that you just don't want to fuck with. I mean, he is built like a brick house.
He comes in and he never speaks to any of the characters. And I don't think he ever comes in when any of the characters are conscious or there. Like, he comes in while Welton is sleeping and does his thing and leaves. And then he comes in... to Horlick.
And Horlick are gone.
Or
no, they hear him coming and they sneak away.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
To ring the bells, to let everybody know that it's time for them to do their jobs.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, is that for as badass as this guy and as big as this guy is, there, I don't know what it is about him, but there's a real feeling like he still isn't the guy in charge.
No,
he's just another cog in all of this.
Just a cog, a higher up cog, or even if that is higher up, he's just somebody else doing their job.
Right.
And so the next scene that we have is Horlick and Exley being introduced to each other, and there's a fight because he stole her cantaloupes. And she ends up dislocating his shoulder, right?
Right.
And tying him up. And he's kind of a nasty little boy. And then she kind of breaks through to him. And they start a friendship.
Yeah. Horlick was a character that I had a problem with in this book. And I can't put my finger on it if it was the way he was drawn or the fact that he was just such a little shit. And I think it's a combination of the two, and it's more, I think, the way he's drawn, because, you know, when we first see him and he's found the candle, or he's stolen the cantaloupes, he cuts it in half with this giant machete that he has, and you assume he's going to eat it, because there's, you know, just the society that they're in. But then he pokes his whole finger in it, and decides he's going to fuck the cantaloupe instead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Exley bursts in on him. But it just, the way he's drawn like this just, like, younger kid. Like, a kid who's too young to, you know, be fucking cantaloupes.
Yeah.
And so I know that, you know, they're probably trying to set it up as he's, you know, this kid who's had to grow up too fast and in a world without responsible adults and all these other things. But I just thought that the combination of the way he was drawn and the fact that he's just such a little shit, I had a hard time with that character. But I loved the way that Exley dealt with him. I thought the way Exley dealt with him was brilliant.
Yeah, no, definitely. And he softens up and he really becomes a likable character in the end. And you kind of see why he is the way he is, because he has an older brother named Dennis who, just as soon as you see him, he did a great job. George O'Connor did a great job drawing this character and designing this character, because as soon as you see him, I just recognized him as one of those guys you see in 7-Eleven that just looks angry and just looks pissed off at all times, and you know, you don't want to even like have any interactions with that person because they're not in a mindset to deal with human beings.
No, and he's a manipulative fuck, and I mean,
and you can see where if that was your older brother and maybe your only role model that you have, you know, that's why you're such a fucked up individual, you know, growing up especially.
Right.
But what I liked about that character, Horlick, is that you see him being this terrible little kid, and then you see him kind of morph into like how kids are that I've dealt with, you know. Right. Often, like when you first meet a kid, they're very standoffish and maybe they are a jerk, but once you get to know them and break through that barrier, you know, they can be really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how he ends up.
Right. He's shown, he reflects the love that he's shown.
Exactly.
And I thought the Exley character was a very complex character that she has to be tough and has to be a survivor and has to be, you know, all these things that one would have to be to get through in this world.
But she almost comes across as innocent.
Right. She still believes that there's some good. She was an actress who fell in love with a musician and basically spends her days looking for this musician again to get back together with him. And it's a very romantic and, like you said, innocent approach to life, especially in such a just
chaotic world. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, all of the characters were incredibly complex in this book, I felt like there was no real two-dimensional character in here. And I felt like for getting that across in 134 pages was a real feat, especially a lot of this book is drawn and not spoken.
Exactly.
There isn't a whole lot of dialogue in this book.
No.
And so Adam Rapp really does a great job of economy of dialogue and getting across what he needs to and leaving out what he doesn't.
What I thought was what he did use so well in here was sound.
Mm-hmm.
That there are sound effects in this book, but they're carefully chosen. Not everything has a sound effect, but when there's a sound effect, it's very carefully chosen, and it just intensifies the situation. I'm looking on page 78 and 79 here, where the collector has come and he is tattooing the numbers on Underjohn, and there's this silent struggle. And then out comes the tattoo gun, and then you hear the zzz, zzz, zzz of the tattoo gun, and then a shkrip of the tape as he tapes over it. And then
To bandage it up.
And then everything else is silent as he's taking everything apart, everything down. It's been a very good setup. You know, he set up his whole operating table, everything else, and then it's just a scrape as the lid comes back down because he's coming up out of the sewer.
Yeah.
And then clunk, and that's it. And then Welton picks up his guitar and starts to play it, but you don't hear the music.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like I said, I mean, there's just these very, very careful uses of sound. The one that was just so powerful was when that same character comes back, but this time he's the bell ringer. And those bells are just, I mean, you can tell how terrifying they are and how they echo through this whole building.
Yeah.
And, I mean, just such a great use of sound effects. And sound effects are something that have almost completely left comics, especially mainstream comics now. And so this was such an effective use of it to add to that feeling of tension and
yeah,
terror.
No, it really builds a lot of atmosphere. And in that same one, it really starts with you see that there's a fluorescent bulb. It's those long fluorescent lights. And you see that one of them is out and it's zzz, you know, as those things hum. That's really how this scene is set. And the guy comes through out of the manhole with the scrape and the clunk. And then he changes that light bulb. And the whole time you're seeing the zzz across as that light bulb hums. And then it goes to the rest of what you described before. Mm-hmm. And so there's this whole silent scene where all it is sound effects and there's no words and dialogue whatsoever.
Right.
And it just creates this incredible tension for that whole scene. I felt that a lot of the art and the choices of the shots that we're showing were very much in the vein of like a David Lynch movie,
mm-hmm.
where you have somebody saying something despicable and you just get a close-up of just their mouth speaking it, or them relating a story of how something happened, and you see the you know, like when he's talking about how the vaccine was sent up from Mexico and they drove for 5 days straight, and there's just one panel of like the truck driver and the woman just like partying like crazy, and that is such a David Lynch way of showing things. And so it was a beautiful book, just shot by shot, how it flowed through.
Right. I mean, like I said, for 135 pages, where, I mean, and here's the thing, is that not a whole lot happens.
Uh-uh.
I mean, but at the same time, so much happens. I mean, that's the thing, is that it's so much happens in a character arc sense.
Yeah.
While there's no real activity in this book, the character arc is amazing.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes me feel like I want to know more, because now we have these just fully fleshed out characters here, or at least very well fleshed out characters. And now I want to see them interact a little bit more in this world and figure out, you know, it, the other, the, I mean, Welton is Bagger 27. And under John is, you know, he's number, Welton is Dragger number 27. And Sacker,
Under John
is Sacker 112. So, are there that many more people out there?
Yeah.
Or is it that he is the 27th person and the 112th person to have these jobs, and there's just this constant rollover? Because, you know, that's the reason Under John is there, is that the last guy's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, is there that kind of turnover in the position? I mean, there's so many unanswered questions that come about because this much time was taken to flesh out the characters and the environment.
And really, all he needs is little bits and pieces to, like, tantalize you. Like, it's mentioned that Exley is from Uptown, where people don't have it as bad off.
Right.
And so you really get this sense that there's people that are doing better and that this is sort of like the slums of the area or whatever. And you also get little tidbits like that the clock tower isn't working anymore because it was bombed. And so you get a sense that this was due to war.
Right.
So it's all these little bits and pieces that he just very carefully chooses to put in there that give you a sense of what's going on without revealing too much of the story.
Right. And that's the thing, is that it would be pretty easy to take this and, yeah, just drop little bits and little bits and little bits,
mm-hmm.
and just keep building up the character interaction. And I would even take this book, set it on the shelf, walk away from it, and have them start over with a whole new set of characters in a different environment or a different part of town,
yeah.
or a different interaction, and have that be what fills in the gaps
for me. I mean, you could have a completely different book here if you just showed what things were like in the Uptown, you know? Mm-hmm. You could have a completely different atmosphere and feel and tension there than what's in this book, and it would be great. I completely trust this creative team,
mm-hmm.
to do that well, because they worked with so little and crafted something so dense, I feel, that I would enjoy seeing anything else that these guys do.
Right. This is the kind of book that you sit down, you read it, you enjoy it, you walk away from it for a little while to decompress a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, I come back to like reading a Chuck Palahniuk book. I mean, you got to decompress after reading that. You come back to it, and now that you know the situation, you know the characters, you know the ending, and I got to say, the ending in this book is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really powerful ending. Now that you know all that stuff, now you can go back and you can absorb a little bit more. You can start to find some of those little details along the way,
yeah.
that really paint it even more. The use of color in this book is amazing and insane. How everything's muted until the very end, and then you get this pink that gets introduced.
Uh-huh.
And the pink just stands out in this world so tremendously, and that's important to have, but to find even more little details of that, I'm sure they're in here.
To find the kind of consistency and tone between the writing and the artist, and usually that only happens with somebody that does both pieces, like a mm-hmm. Jeff Lemire or something like that, a Paul Pope, to find that consistency and tone in between the dialogue and the writing and the panel structure and the coloring and everything. It's really cool to see it between a creative team, and I really hope that these guys continue working together, because they're really in sync on this book.
Yeah, this is going to... We're in October now. This is probably going to end up on my top five list for the year. I mean, really, I'm looking at this book. I'm looking at what's come before it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, really, this book just... I mean, I didn't know what to expect coming out, you know, when we picked it up. It was one that looked interesting, but not necessarily must have.
Yeah.
And so I really came into this with no expectations whatsoever. And I'm so glad we picked it up because it is, I mean, it catches you off guard. I sat down.
It was a really pleasant surprise to read this.
I read this in the airport, just waiting for the plane, and read it all in one giant gulp, and then spent the entire plane ride just thinking about this book.
Oh, that I think that would be a great way to experience it, yeah.
Because, like I said, you've got to decompress from it, but it's haunting. Uh-huh. I mean, really, there isn't a wasted moment in this book.
Yeah, definitely not. And it's really surprising how much he really didn't write into this book. He did not overwrite this book at all. Like, there are so many pages that are just without dialogue and just really set the tone for the whole atmosphere.
Right. It's, and that's the thing, is that it is a dialogue book. It is a character book. It's not an action book. The whole thing, I mean, you think about it, where the setup is people, you know, clunking kids on the head with hammers, that there would be, you know, some sort of horror element to it with that, or a gross out element, or an action element to it. But there's none of that in this book.
Yeah, I mean, definitely not.
It's the real horror comes from the situation and how these people are living and interacting with each other, and the choices that they, I don't even know if it's a choice, but the decisions that they make that allow them to stay alive, and what that trade-off is.
Yeah. And this is besides the craft that went into the making of the book, the actual quality of the book is really high quality paper with a great design on the front and the back. Like, this cover made me want to pick it up and was interested in the cover. Or the book, just by the cover.
Right.
It has a really interesting picture of Exley on the front with a gas mask and a sort of club and, like, combat boots. And it's just a very dramatic figure. Mm-hmm. And it's called Ball-Peen Hammer. And I, to tell you the truth, was expecting it to be kind of a cheesy action kind of a book. And this was incredibly deep and just very smartly configured.
Well, you know, getting back to that cover, the picture of Exley on the cover, at first grasp, yeah, she looks pretty badass, but then if you look at her, the body language, the way her feet are pointed in, her knees are together, there's an awkwardness to this as well that goes back to that whole idea that she's from a different part of town where things are a little bit better, and
instead of looking to be like an aggressor, she looks like she's backed into the corner.
Right, it's more defensive than offensive. And so again, it's that attention to detail. Mm-hmm. They could have seriously put her in a badass pose on the cover and, you know, I'm going to kick your ass. And while, yes, because I think that is in Exley's character to do that, if pushed.
Yeah.
This is a much more telling pose that, yeah, she'll kick your ass if you mess with her.
Yeah.
If you don't mess with her, she's going to go about her business and try to survive and live and go back to try to find this guy that she, you know, she's in love with. So it's that kind of attention to detail. I'm not just going to draw Exley, but I'm going to draw her in a way that conveys all this about her.
Definitely.
And you know, again, that kind of attention to detail is fantastic.
Well, I really hope that they're working on another book, because this creative team was in lockstep together and put out a great product.
Well, and we were talking, is that, you know, at the end, it says that Adam Rapp's a novelist, playwright, screenwriter, and filmmaker. And it's got young adult novels and adult novels, and apparently a movie called Winter Passing. That's going on my Netflix queue when I get home.
Yeah, it was a good movie too.
So
Lindsay and I both enjoyed it.
That kind of thing makes me, like you said, I mean, makes me want to go and find more. And then George O'Connor's other graphic novel is Journey into Mohawk Country, published by First Second. So again, there's another graphic novel out there by George O'Connor, and like you said, I mean, this artwork is done so well. I want to see what else he's done. I want to go find more and see, like you said, I mean, these two were working together so well. I want to see what that artwork looks like with a different writer and what kind of, try to get a feel for what he brought to this as well.
Yeah, no, I would highly suggest watching Winter Passing because I can really see elements that are the same within it. They're completely different stories, completely different settings, but there's a lot of the same kind of tone and kind of brilliance with only bringing in the things that are necessary. That same sort of attention to excising the fat, you know, cutting out the fat.
Fantastic. And, you know, at $17.99, even full price, $17.99, this is a quality product.
I was really disappointed in the price when I picked it up.
Right.
But after reading it, it's totally worth it.
No, this is, you know, I'm a fan of the discount. I'm a fan of Amazon and eBay and, you know, talking to your local comic book shop and, you know, trying to cut a deal with them and get a discount on it. If you can't, don't walk away from this book. $17.99, pay the price, enjoy the book. It really, this one's going on the shelf in a place of honor.
And no, like I definitely agree with you that this is probably top five book this year.
Yeah, this is really going down as one of the best books I've read this year.
Yeah.
Top to bottom. And yeah, like you said, I mean, that's the other thing is that, you know, I want to know, is there more? Is there another story? And, you know, half of me really wants it to be there, and half of me is really nervous that it is. I mean, because
I'm not as nervous. I definitely think that I'll enjoy it, and so I would look forward to another book.
Yeah.
You have been listening to Stumptown Trade Review, your online resource for independent trades and graphic novels. Thanks for listening.